making awful love.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Junkions, prepare thyself for another fantastic episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmScoreRejects.com.
.com.
This is the weekly cult and exploitation filmcast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. All for one, and one for Olive Garden. I am Brian Salisbury. He is my co-host. He is a novelist. He's a screenwriter. He's a lieutenant of Megaforce. He's the fifth Mouseketeer, C. Robert Cargill.
Hi. You've been waiting all day for that Olive Garden joke, haven't you?
I really have.
You really have. Like, the way that came out, it's like, yeah, he was really excited about the Olive Garden joke.
When you're here, you're terrible at this.
I am a novelist, and I'll mention right up front.
Do it.
I'm going to do a shameless plug, because you know what? It's September. I've got a book that's been out for 2 weeks. People are really digging it. If you dig this podcast, it's the type of thing you might like. It's a post-apocalyptic robot Western. It's called Sea of Rust, and I would really love it if you guys could track down a copy and read it and see if you enjoy it. So
you should definitely do that. And a shameless plug is the best plug for Junk Food Cinema, because if you've been listening to the show,
we have no shame.
You know full well that shame is not on the menu at any point. We are going to talk about movies that we love regardless of how they were received, regardless of how they're remembered, regardless of their perceived lack of quality, because we legitimately love these movies. And if you want to hear more about us legitimately loving these movies, we have 3+ years of, I don't even know how long we've been doing, over 3 years.
3.5 years.
Three and a half years.
With like a break when I was in London. We tried to make the London thing work, and it just didn't work.
Man, it's like Friends. Things got weird when people go to London.
We did 2 episodes, and it's like, yeah, this just isn't, we have to be in the same room. So aside from that, yeah, we've got 3.5 years of backlog that you can find wherever you're listening to this. And
be it iTunes, be it the Blog Talk Radio Network, which is our host and our home. They have our entire catalog available. You can get it on any podcatcher pretty much that you use. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, Facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema if you want to go there. I highly recommend that if you are a Patreon, which I'm going to get to in a second, we have a closed group on Facebook just for you. And I actually revealed via that group which movies we're going to be covering for the next 2 weeks. So you get to know shit early, and it's really cool. How do you get to know shit early? You go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and you'd support us via Patreon.
Where you get for just $1 a month.
$1 an episode.
$1 an episode. Yeah. I'm sorry. $1 a week. You get bonus content. You get our extra episodes. You get our mailbags. You get episodes like you're going to get this week, where we're going to talk about one of the great character actors of all time and go over his career. And you help keep the lights on here at Junk Food Headquarters.
So much appreciated. I can't even tell you.
I feel like Junk Food Headquarters should be like the mall
food court.
The mall food court in heaven. Like,
yes,
where we just,
yes,
like,
I
where,
love this.
Where the, a Chick-fil-A that's open on Sundays,
and is accepting of gays.
And Whataburger, and, you know, just all the great junk food that you can have together.
Oh, God.
Yeah,
I'm getting fatter just thinking about this wonderful utopia.
That's where when we die, that's where we're going to go. You know, Rose went to the Titanic. We go to Junk Food Paradise.
We go to Chewtopia.
I feel like Junk Food Paradise is also the best meatloaf song ever written.
Well, I can see Junk Food Paradise by the dashboard light when I'm on my way to Whataburger to get me that that honey butter chicken biscuit, because good damn, am I right?
I would do anything for an apple pie,
but I'll
fry it in a vat.
And I would do anything for love, but I won't do that.
That's my new karaoke jam right there.
And you know, because you could go right into I don't do that. Like, it's already there.
You could do an entire video where it says, I'll do anything for food, but I won't do that. Just pointing at the few fast food items that you won't actually consume, and 90% of them are at Taco Bell.
Yeah.
As it turns out.
Well, mine have guacamole on it. It's I just, for some reason, that's my kryptonite.
Really? Guacamole? Yeah,
guacamole.
And you live in what state?
I know. The state of delusion. The state of not quite getting Mexican food entirely.
In the true tradition of the show, I'm busting your balls for something that I actually totally agree with. I can't stand guacamole.
I don't fault anybody for it, but it's I get double sour cream whenever I get fajitas. So.
Fuck yeah, because sour cream is like if avocados were capable of making something great, it would be sour cream. But unfortunately, they make guacamole instead.
They make hipster food.
They make green toothpaste that you put on your... I don't get it.
But to those of you listening, no judgment. I mean, the things we put in our body, we can't judge.
This is true. Let me have my fifth beer today. So this movie, speaking of not being able to judge anyone...
Dude, I fucking love this. Don't you love this movie?
I actually do. Again, busting balls for things I agree with.
This is one I was really excited about because I tweeted about it the other night on my birthday this year, just a couple weeks ago. Got a bunch of friends together. We went out and had this meal kind of gangster style in the back of an Italian restaurant because I found this really cool Italian restaurant that had a room that's like, yeah, you can reserve the room. And I'm like, I can eat like a gangster. This will be great.
When he says the back of the Italian restaurant, he means the alley where they put the food on a little box, no. And then they shared a piece of spaghetti until the middle.
No, I mean they have a full-on room where we could get drunk and rowdy, and the rest of the place is quiet, and we're just like guzzling Italian food and drinking great wine. And so we then retired to my place to, you know, open up a really great bottle of scotch that my wife got me for my birthday. And after everyone cleared out, one of my friends that you guys know, Wendy, friend of the show, she stuck around, and somehow we got talking about this movie, and I'm like, fuck it. It's my birthday. I want to watch this movie. She's like, I want to watch this movie. So we sat down and killed a bottle of scotch and watched this movie, and I tweeted about it. And man, for a movie that has been so kind of kicked in the nuts for 2.5 decades, there's a lot of love for this movie out there. And it warmed my heart. It's like, God damn, you know what? We need to do an episode on this because it's high time we give this movie its due, because this is legitimately one of the classics of the 90s that does not get credit for being a classic of the 90s. It is a film that does everything it's trying to do. There's not a moment in the film that doesn't work. It is just a flawless, entertaining family adventure film with some of the greatest character actors of its time.
So draw your young swords and take a ride with The Three Musketeers.
You're under arrest.
Five of them, three of us. Hardly seems fair.
Maybe we should give him a chance to surrender.
Athos, Porthos, and Aramis.
Hello.
Nice to meet you again.
Pleasure.
Now, we are prepared to resist you.
Walt Disney Pictures presents the story of the greatest heroes who ever lived.
Long live the Musketeers!
The Three Musketeers.
Because, let's be real, Young Swords should have been the title of this fucking movie, right? I mean, you got Kiefer Sutherland, you got Charlie Sheen, basically doing Young Guns with rapiers.
You know, I guarantee you that's how they sold it.
They were like, you know
what we should do? We should totally capitalize on Young Guns, but what if they were the Three Musketeers? And it's like, holy shit, that's brilliant. But, you know, they were like, well, who are we going to get to play Porthos? And then they were struck with a stroke of fucking genius.
Yeah.
And cast a guy at the time who was an up and coming character actor who had also worked with Kiefer Sutherland before, because this could also be sword liners.
Oh, okay.
if we're gonna be making terrible titles. Yeah.
Which we do.
Yeah, because you know, he worked with Kiefer Sutherland on Flatliners. I have to say, and this is one of the things that I've always loved about this movie, one of the reasons I have held this movie so close to my heart, is because Oliver Platt is one of my very favorite character actors. In fact, rewatching this and thinking about it, I realized that somewhere down the road, Take a Drink, Junkies, we need to do an Oliver Platt month, because Oliver Platt is in so many satisfying fucking films, and at the same time, also in several films that are really great that were mostly ignored at the time or completely forgotten. So I was like, oh, we gotta do something with Oliver Platt, because I You've got this.
I'm sorry. We're going to serve up an Oliver platter. Come on.
There
folks.
It is.
Come
it's
on.
It's going to be Oliver platter. That's exactly what it's going to be. Because, you know, I know there's at least one movie on your mind that you're going to be like, oh, we got to do that.
I just talked about this movie the other day and how, and I, if we're talking about the same movie, and how the creator of that movie created some of the best television shows of all time and then fucked up making a movie so tremendously that it just boggles my mind. It's like, how do you fuck up a crocodile movie? I don't understand it.
And yet it's kind of,
and yet it's
Lake Placid. It's still fucking great.
I have to share a quick story about Lake Placid, because my stepson is now getting into the genre of movies where things eat people. Like, he's getting really into it.
Is it okay? So is it things eat people, or is it pissed off nature?
No, it's specifically creatures that eat people.
Okay.
And it makes sense because the first movie he ever saw in theaters was Jurassic World, and he loved it. So I showed him Deep Blue Sea for the first time, and he lost his tiny little mind.
Of course
he did. Loved it. And he actually watched the scene where Samuel L. Jackson gets killed, and I was watching his face because I'm like, he knows him as Nick Fury. This is going to be a real – he's going to have problems with this.
You're going to scar your child for life.
I had to know. So the shark comes out and grabs him. There is no reaction. He's looking right at the screen. And then he just looked at me and goes, is he going to be okay?
Is he going to? No.
Is he gonna
no.
Okay? And this is like right after they tear him in half. And I'm like, I don't think he's coming back from that.
You surprised me.
I often have that effect on people.
But I also want to speak to what you said about how they sold this movie as it being Young Guns with Three Musketeers, Young Swords. It has gotten to the point, doing the show, watching enough movies, that now when I watch trailers, there is a phenomena. A frequency at which I can hear elevator pitches in trailers now.
Oh, yeah.
There was a trailer for this movie about firefighters, like forest firefighters, right? And Jeff Bridges is in it doing his usual marble-mouthed thing that he does. And he has a line in the trailer where he says, we're basically the SEAL Team 6 of firefighters. And I'm like, that was it. That was the fucking pitch that sold this movie, and you had a character state it in the trailer.
Yep.
Are you kidding me with this?
That was the 90s for you, my friend.
And here we have Three Musketeers, which I have to say, I remember very little about this movie, but there were a couple of scenes that I'm like, I had seen this movie as a kid and just completely forgotten about it until one of those scenes is where Charlie Sheen shoots a guy and then does the sign of the cross with the pistol as it's smoking, and I'm like, I remember that. I remember that entirely.
Yeah, this movie is, yeah, you go with the pitch. I guarantee you there's something else tied into this. Let's talk about the marketing and the whole concept of this, because they definitely were going with Young Guns doing an adventure film, but it was Young Guns. I guarantee the elevator pitch is, it's Young Guns meets Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And then what we'll do is we'll get, instead of having one popular singer croon a song about love, we'll get three popular singers to croon together.
Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, and it will all for one, one for all, something like that, you know, and we'll do that. And all of a sudden you can see Disney salivating.
I will see that fantasy scenario and raise you that then someone else walked in the room after they said, well, how do we structure it? And someone walked in the room and goes, oh, you know what I just watched last night? The Princess Bride. And they went, ah, ha, ha, ha. Let's base a lot of this on the fucking Princess Bride. Why not?
Yes. Do they fucking rip off Goldman in this? We'll get there. We will get there. But there's so much to unpack here. But the
there's at least three things to unpack, possibly four.
The main stressor here is, I believe I've watched it three times in the last 3 weeks as a result, because my wife had passed out. She the scotch hit her a little hard, and she was there for the opening credits. She had never seen it. She had escaped the 90s without seeing it. So I'm like, we got to watch this. I'll watch this again. She was like, are you sure? I'm like, yes, I'm very sure. I want to watch this again. And so we watched it and she fell in love with it. But I then was like, I was up late one night and I'm like, ah, I should watch Flash Gordon or something. And I kind of want to watch Three Musketeers. And I'm like, oh shit, this is that moment. This is the moment where this goes from being one of those artifacts that I've loved and cherished for years, but not really watched regularly. And now it slips into rotation. And this becomes one of my travel movies. And this becomes something that it's like, you know what? I kind of want to watch Three Musketeers, because from beginning to end, this movie's never boring.
Yep.
This movie never fails at what it's attempting to do.
Correct.
It is so lean and mean, and it has so many of my favorite character actors. Like, literally, we are going to spend some time talking about each one of these character actors. All chewing up the scenery in the best fucking way possible.
All chewing up their individual covers of Tiger Beat the entire time.
Oh, I mean, it's... Well, I'm not just talking about them. I mean,
oh, I know who you're actually talking about.
I mean,
about.
There's a couple legends in here, particularly from this era. And this is such an elegantly told masterwork of mainstream movie making. Like, this is exactly everything you wanted to get out of a movie when you went to the movies in the 90s, and it is perfectly executed, and it just flies. You pop that thing on and it's fucking over, and you're like, holy shit, I just watched a whole movie, and it was there. Like, it just
there and gone like a musketeer. It is amazing. It is astronomical how many buckles get swashed in this film. So much swashbuckling done with an Errol Flynn level of competency that I gotta be honest, I didn't remember how good the sort of adventure-y, the sword fighting and the playfulness of the fights and the adventure. And like, it had such an old school feel to it.
It does. Well, that's exactly what they were going for. They were,
and
going
I don't just mean because it's set in the fucking 1600s, yeah. But, you know.
No, like, it felt like an old family Disney movie. It felt like they were going for Errol Flynn without going for the pageantry of Errol Flynn. But I will also say, this is not the only Three Musketeers movie that came out in the 90s. And it's crazy when you compare this to the other Three Musketeers movie that came out in the 90s and the cast that movie had, that this movie pistol whips the shit out of Man in the Iron Mask. No, I mean, let me just run down, because we're going to talk about this movie, but let me run down the cast for those of you who have forgotten Man in the Iron Mask.
Come on, do it!
Leonardo DiCaprio. Jeremy Irons.
People you've heard of.
John Malkovich.
You might have heard of.
Gerard Depardieu. Gabriel Byrne.
What?
Like, I mean, it is Peter Sarsgaard.
What?
Oh, yeah. Hugh Laurie.
What?
David Lowe. Like, I mean, seriously, what? This is such a crazy cast. And it's like, wait, that's the cast of the second best Three Musketeers movie of the 90s? Yes, it is.
I want to take a quick second, because of what you've been saying and because of what we've been talking about with the adventure and everything, to credit the director of this film, Mr. Stephen Herrick, because he has given us some really fucking fantastic junk food worthy movies. Get your flask ready, because you're going to be taking a lot of drinks.
Yeah, let's write them down.
Ready for this? Critters.
Yes.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh, hell yes.
The Mighty Ducks.
Yeah.
Mr. Holland's goddamn Opus.
That's a movie that in the 90s nobody really wanted to like, and we all fucking liked anyway.
And Don't Tell Mom,
The
Babysitter's Dead.
Oh, dear God.
Yes.
The dishes are done, dude. Yeah.
My favorite part of that movie is the kid who plays the oldest son in that film was also in Adventures in Babysitting, like, the year before,
yeah.
Which led to the theory that he only appeared in movies with the word babysitter in the title. That's all I'm going to say. But yeah, this is a great director for us.
Yeah, and he is firing on all cylinders here. Like, he just, like, everything in this movie just works. It looks good. It's shot incredibly well. The DP on this just did a fantastic job with a lot of it. All the comedy beats, almost all the comedy beats are great. There's one or two jokes that it's like, that joke kind of falls flat. I see why that was something they did at the time, but it doesn't really carry, but it barely falls flat. There's nothing groan-worthy in this movie. And everything that's over the top is supposed to be over the top. And to put a fine point on this, I have been a Three Musketeers fan for a long time. In that, when I was a kid, I read Dumas' fucking tome.
Oh, I thought you were just giving a big fuck you to Milky Way.
No, no. Three Musketeers bars, also delicious. Gee, I wonder what today's junk food pairing is. If you don't suggest deep frying it, I'm very disappointed in you.
You're kind of letting all the cats out of the bag, goddammit.
I really am. I really am. I'm sorry. I apologize.
You're letting out Pathos, Porthos, Darjeeling Limited. I don't know. They're all named. They all have weird names.
But no, I was a big fan of Dumas' work. The Three Musketeers, the book is such a great fun adventure book, but it's also a great lesson for a writer because it shows what a very different era it was, because there's so many errors in that book. Like, when you start becoming a deep fan of that book, you start noticing logic flaws, like the fact that in the book, the Three Musketeers take D'Artagnan down to get sworn in as a musketeer twice. Like, 30 chapters later, they're like, you should probably be a musketeer. And it's like, no, dude, see, totally, you made him a musketeer 30 chapters ago.
Yeah, just
no, let's
badge.
Take him down. He gets sworn in again. Because Dumas forgot.
He pulled a fucking Samuel Taylor Coleridge and wrote half the book on opium and then woke up and wrote the rest.
Yeah, so...
Kublai Khan, motherfucker!
I've always said that you are as intelligent as you are beautiful.
But so this movie takes this huge, thick fucking book, adventure book, and boils it down to a lean, 100 minutes.
No. It does not boil it down. It vat fries it down to somehow it puts it into deep fryer and comes out with something lean. You're absolutely right, which is miraculous in and of itself. But yeah, there is no dead air in this entire movie.
No. And in fact, it's a masterclass in how to give tiny bits of information that set up very complicated plots, because the way the information is unraveled in this movie, the way we're introduced to Richelieu at the beginning, the way all the information is given out about D'Artagnan's father, without anyone ever sitting down and go, let me tell you the story about Papa D'Artagnan. Like, it is, we are given all, I think, 6 or 7 salient pieces of information in 1-2 line little bits over the course of the entire movie. And by the end, you're like, I know who D'Artagnan's dad was, and I care about this and D'Artagnan, despite the fact that it's Chris O'Donnell.
let's
begin with D'Artagnan.
D'Artagnan. Ahoy.
Because if there's anything that some people will criticize about this movie, it is Chris O'Donnell.
And we can't fight those people on that criticism, as it turns out.
I disagree. Like, this is the thing, is because Wendy and I had a long conversation about this, because I feel that everything Chris O'Donnell is doing for D'Artagnan is absolutely correct. Like, the thing is D'Artagnan is not supposed to be a fully formed musketeer. He's not supposed to be this guy that's already got his shit together and can whip the shit out of the Three Musketeers. He is a mess, but he's a kid, and these musketeers keep looking at him and going, I like the balls on this kid.
Yeah, but
like, this kid's got balls. After some shaping, he could be great. And ultimately, when we get to it through the plot of the movie, when we get to it at the end, he saves the king, but he doesn't do anything that anyone else couldn't have done.
Because Charlie Sheen's busy doing the same Scooby-Doo gag like 5 times in this movie and actually saving the king. And I actually kind of dug that. Also, they kept going back to that well.
Also, this is the interesting thing about this film and this cast, because we're going to run down the cast in a moment, but Charlie Sheen has top billing here.
Yeah.
He has top billing over Kiefer Sutherland here. Like, think about that. Like, think about if they made a movie today, who would get top billing? Charlie Sheen would be 4th or 5th down the line. But
then again, probably so would Kiefer Sutherland.
Kiefer Sutherland, though, is the star of this movie.
100%. Like, I don't disagree with that at all.
Like, he gets all the real meaty bits of this movie. He gets all the best scenes. He gets all the best dialogue that isn't given to Oliver Platt. Because let's face it, Oliver Platt, every moment Oliver Platt is in this movie, he steals the fucking movie. He has the greatest scene in this film, actually. But also, Kiefer pays that off as well. This movie opens up and the credits are like, Charlie Sheen. It's like, yeah. Charlie Sheen kind of is barely in the movie. Like, that's the thing.
Which is because he was just coming off the set of Hot Shots, I believe, Part 2. and was like literally they dragged him off of one set and put him onto this one. He didn't do any of the fencing training that O'Donnell and Sutherland and Platt went through, and just kind of it very Charlie Sheen-esque, just kind of got dumped into this and was like, all right, let's go, whatever, let's do this.
Which explains why he does the why he has the, and by the way, borrowed Raiders of the Lost Ark gag, where
doesn't Platt's the one who does that. Because the only reason I remember that is because it comes right after a vaguely racist dig on Asian people, where he's they're on a pirate ship, and the only Asian character, the only Asian in France at this time, is trying to fight him and is doing all these like spin kicks and getting ready to hit him, and Oliver Platt just goes wah, and then hits a lever and a trap door opens and the guy falls.
No, I'm talking about during the fight at the end of the movie when all the musketeers have shown up and are all battling at once against Richelieu's guards, and Charlie Sheen does a couple sword swings and then pulls out a gun and shoots a guy and then does the sign of the cross with
right.
him.
Right. Well, there's a lot they stole from Indiana Jones now that I think about
there's
it.
There's a lot they stole from a lot of things, which is part of why this works. I mean, no. And that's, I heavily, heavily believe in this. Good artists borrow, great artists steal. And this movie steals heavily from several things that really worked previously that work here. And in retrospect, you can totally forgive the theft. Like at the time, a lot of us looked side-eye at the whole subplot with the one-eyed man.
The
six-figure, the one-eyed man.
Instead of giving him more things, we're going to take one thing away, and no one will ever know the difference.
And, I remember the first time I was watching this movie during that scene. You have D'Artagnan, and he's battling the guy who we know what he's done, but D'Artagnan doesn't know yet, and he drops the bomb on him. But while it's happening, I'm just leaning over to my friend going, hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. And I keep doing that, and on the fifth time I do that, I go, hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. At the moment that Chris O'Donnell goes, you killed my father? And my buddy just looked at me, and he's like, you've seen this? I'm like, no, this is the first time. That scene stolen wholeheartedly, but talk about favorite character actors. Fucking Michael Wincott in that role.
Yeah.
Fucking chews the scenery beautifully.
So fucking
you
amazing.
Guys will know Michael Wincott from, he was the villain in The Crow. He was the second in command in, again, why I think this was part of the pitch, in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Oh, sure.
Why a spoon, cousin?
Because it's dull, you twit, little hat more.
He's what I think is the very best part of Alien Resurrection, a movie that a lot of people hate, but I love the first hour of Alien Resurrection because it's Joss Whedon's space pirates, and everything with that group of space pirates is awesome, and Michael Wincott is the captain of the ship, and I'm just like, I just eat that whole hour of that movie up. But Michael Wincott is so good here doing this, and playing second fiddle to one of the greatest character actors of all time.
Now,
also,
who could you possibly be talking about?
Tim fucking Curry.
Yeah.
Your sacrifice brings you closer to God.
But it is not God to whom I wish to be close.
Tim Curry as Cardinal Richelieu is so delicious. Like, he's enjoying every fucking moment of it, including the creepy, ooky molestation, sexual harassment scenes.
I don't use the word mincing very often, but if there is one adjective that describes Tim Curry's performance in this movie, oh God, like, you want to take a shower anytime he looks at you. You're just like, ah.
Oh yeah, every scene with a woman, he's just fucking awful.
Even the most chaste of men would think of immoral things, and it's like, oh my God, stop.
It's like, and the beauty of it is hearing that come out of Frankenfurter's mouth is just, there's just a magic to it. Like, especially at this period of time when this movie came out, this was in my period where I was, you know, in the Rocky Horror Picture Show for 5 years, where I was a crowd hustler and for a while cast manager. So I would spend every Friday and Saturday night with Tim Curry on screen. So anytime Tim Curry came out in anything, it was just like, fuck yeah, I'm there. And watching him play Cardinal Richelieu as kind of a de facto Frankenfurter, as, you know, Cardinal who wants to be Pope, was something that always tickled me. And he just tears pieces of the scenery off and just devours it.
He has a very specific eating disorder where he will only subside on pieces of scenery.
Dude, the beauty of him, this is one of my favorite Tim Curry anecdotes. He used to go around to conventions in the 80s and early 90s, and he wore a pin on his whenever he would go, and he had this pin that he wore for all of these things, and it said "Great for Turkeys." And because that's what he saw his career as. He was the prototype for what Bruce Campbell became. He was the guy who's like, yeah, I'm doing movies that don't do well. I'm doing fucking turkeys that bomb at the box office, but I'm working and I'm having fun and I have fans and this is a great life.
Here's the difference between somebody like Tim Curry and people like, I don't know, Bruce Willis. You will never find, you can watch movies until the day you die. You will never find Tim Curry sleepwalking through a film.
No.
Or, fuck it, or a video game appearance. Somebody tweeted at us.
Command
& Conquer 3 Red Alert, where he's just like, I'm going to the one place. Oh, he's got a terrible Russian accent. He's like, going to the one place not corrupted by capitalism. Space! And it's just like, what the fuck is
Oh, dude. Again, 90s. Fucking bought that game. Why? Because Tim Curry was fucking in it. Yeah. I mean, this is starting to grasp at what we've talked about several times. Like, the reason why I have a problem with The Shadow is we were such big Tim Curry fans at the time that whenever we would watch The Shadow, once Tim Curry puts the shadow in the vat of water, we would turn it off because Curry wins.
Yeah. No, I get that. I think that's a great theory. He's also the reason we might talk about Congo at some point on this show. I said might.
Yeah. Dude, don't take a drink for that. Maybe take a sip.
Here's what I'm going to say. You mentioned the analog of Tim Curry being Bruce Campbell.
Yeah.
Guess who are both in the fucking movie Congo?
Yep.
Briefly.
Yeah. So we have Wincott and we have Curry, and they are our villains, and they are so delicious. Like, Curry is so over the top, and Wincott is just so subtly growling over to the side and doing that great. He's got one of the greatest voices in cinema history. Like, he's just got that great voice. Like, it's one of my favorite movie lines of all time. Is so simple, but it's the scene in The Crow where Michael Wincott is sitting there with his girlfriend and they've got the girl lying next to them who may or may not be dead. And Wincott just looks over and goes, I think we broke her. And it's so gross and celebratory at the same time. It's just like, oh, dude, this is why I love Michael Wincott. He's so good. And here he is. There's a stiffness to him. Normally he has the swagger because he's the big boss, and this time he's second in command, but he's not goofy like he was in Prince of Thieves. And so he's just fucking a commanding presence here, and they proved the perfect foil for our four heroes.
Well, and what I find interesting, I can't prove this. I don't know if it was the lighting, the DP's decision, but everywhere he goes, everywhere Rochefort goes, he's in shadow in the middle of the day.
Dude, the cinematography in this movie is so good. It's so interesting. There's so many shots that are played from so far away. There's this whole kind of Barry Lyndon quality to it.
Yeah.
Where they're using available light and they're using this beautiful countryside and it is just these elegant shots. This isn't one of those movies that has like the finesse of crazy over the top shots. Instead, it's the simplicity of how every shot is framed and looks. And when you walk into these rooms, you know, the scene where D'Artagnan first wakes up in the bedroom after he's been captured, kind of, is just so beautiful and elegantly lit. And you get this just get this feeling of 17th century France. There's so much of this in this movie that just is so well done. And so I don't think any of that is accident. I think that's all very much like, no, Rochefort needs to be walking in the shadows. That's the whole point of his character. Like,
for sure.
Curry is the guy who's always well lit and always in the light. And Rochefort is the guy in the shadows. He's his shadow man. I guarantee you they fucking, because there's nothing in this film that feels like it accidentally happened.
Oh no, not at all. Also, I find it funny watching this movie after, you know, binging on a bunch of Game of Thrones, because the actual plot in this movie, the sinister plot, is
super
thin. It's like if everyone playing the Game of Thrones was not good at it, was not doing particularly well, because it's like, yeah, you are, your plan is to send a treaty to the Earl of Buckingham to forge an alliance, and then the king's going to be assassinated, and then Cardinal Richelieu will be the king. It's like if Littlefinger took longer to get caught.
And does it, again, it's all the shorthand.
Less time to get caught.
It is the shorthanding of the book. It is really like, well, wow, this is actually very complicated, you know, stuff. It is very proto, Martin, in terms of the inner machinations and the disintegration of the Musketeers and everything that happens. So they've got a...
They're literally the Kingsguard. I just realized that. They are disbanding the Kingsguard.
Yes.
So that they can assassinate the king.
Yes. That is the whole plot of the fucking movie. Dismantle the Kingsguard, assassinate Pathos, the king.
And there's Porthos, and there's Aramis, and D'Artagnan. Sorry.
Yeah. And there's it's a wafer-thin plot. But all of the twists and turns for the characters are fantastic. In fact, the only person who I would argue gets short shifted in this is, of course, Aramis. Mm-hmm.
I liked his story though about like in one of those moments. There's a great line in this movie that I think should be a mantra for this podcast, which is I believe it's D'Artagnan says, Is Aramis Kiefer Sutherland?
No, that's Athos.
Athos. Okay, so Athos, he says, why is Athos drinking alone? Because he takes his drinking seriously.
Yes.
There's
so many great lines in this, and there's so many great lines about drinking in this movie.
Yes.
In fact, I was going to mention this eventually, but before we carry on, got to get to the greatest moment in this movie. They're on the fucking coach. They're being chased. Fucking Porthos pops up and he's like, champagne, because he's having fun with the fact that, oh my
okay,
god,
wait. Let's do the scene.
Yeah, he's having fun with the fact that this is the coach of the cardinal, and it's just loaded with jewels and snacks and great foods and fucking alcohol, and so he's like, champagne.
We're in the middle of a chase, Porthos.
Ah, a nice red then.
And scene.
No, the brilliance of that is that
scene back up.
That seems like that's the joke. And then he comes up with a red and hands it to Aramis or to Athos, who, by the way, then takes it and fucking drinks.
Yes.
Like he just goes for it. Like, because of course he was serious. You don't drink champagne because it's bubbly. You want a nice red. And then, of course, won't give O'Donnell any.
You can't have any. You're too young.
Take the reins, boy.
What I was talking about going back, I think Charlie Sheen, he's the only character that doesn't have a realized arc in this movie. Every other character, including side characters, including characters that are in three scenes in the movie, like Julie Delpy, who we haven't even gotten to yet. Julie Delpy's in this movie just as she was coming up. She plays the handmaiden to the queen. Even she has an arc in this movie, but Charlie Sheen doesn't actually have an arc. Like he's just like, he kind of does in that he is he fell out of love with the church and, he was one of Richelieu's students and then ultimately comes to almost kill Richelieu and ends up bringing Richelieu down. But that's that's dealt with in such a side way that you can feel the satisfaction of that, but it's not as realized an arc as D'Artagnan gets. It's not as realized an arc as Kiefer Sutherland gets. Even Porthos, who is played as the fool, because that's who Porthos is in The Three Musketeers.
The Dread Pirate Chubby.
Yeah.
I believe is who he's playing in this movie.
He spends the whole time kind of building up the fact that he's famous, and of course D'Artagnan doesn't believe him, and then he even gets his just due when Porthos the pirate,
oh yeah, and then those guys pull a Theon Greyjoy and just
dive off the boat, because it's like, oh fuck, we're about to get fucked up. He's like, I told you I was famous. Like, he's been bullshitting this whole time, but actually he is well known, which is glorious. Like, he's got this great arc, and I just feel like Charlie Sheen's character is the only character that's not realized, because then again, there isn't a lot of room for it, because we do get a full Kiefer Sutherland plot.
We get a full D'Artagnan plot, Darth Tanyan, because there's a lot of weird Star Wars shit with that scene too, where it's like,
oh yeah,
the reveal is not you are my father, but you killed my father. And there's literally a scene where he like backflips over Rochefort and then lands during the sword fight, and Rochefort, dressed all in black, goes, impressive. And it's like, Yeah, no, I remember that from Empire Strikes Back. Like, that is very familiar to me.
Yeah.
All for one. And more for me.
Let's go through the rest of the cast, because we've been jumping around, and this cast is so good. Like, there are no characters in this movie that aren't played by, you know, fucking legends of some sort. So we've mentioned the rest of them. Rebecca De Mornay.
You want to talk about cinematography doing its job.
Oh, yes.
There is a scene where Chris O'Donnell wakes up in a bed lying next to her, and it is shot in...
That was the scene I was talking about, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's shot in boob vision. Like, it's just straight down her corset, like, and she has an amazing chest, and it's just like, oh, awesome.
That's inappropriate.
I'm on board. Whatever. That's how it's shot.
Well, no. Because they're shooting a seduction scene.
Her boobs in that scene could be called front and center.
Also in this movie, first of all, she's fucking great in the movie.
Oh yeah,
like
she's amazing.
The whole subplot with the Countess de Winter is so good, and her ending when she takes the header off the cliff, like her suicide of absolution, is such a good dark moment for a Disney film. Remember, this is Disney's Three Musketeers.
True story.
It is, and fucking she, you know, she finally, she's about to get beheaded by sword. They're out on this beautiful cliff. They've this beautiful, again, the cinematography, this beautiful march up this mountain to the cliff to where, you know, she's going to be beheaded. She finally, you know, she forgives Kiefer. He forgives her. And, so that's taken care of. And then she gives out the last bit of information and then throws herself off the cliff.
I want to point out, by this point in time, Disney had been making movies for 60 years. She is the first character in any Disney movie to commit suicide on screen.
I did not know that.
She is the first fucking character in 60, which is understandable because you make mostly animated films and... What's Dopey gonna, you know, take a few sleeping pills and pass out after a long shift of the mind? No, I get it. I get why you don't normally do it, but it is interesting that it's in this film that we're talking about this week.
That's crazy. Okay, so the queen is played by Gabrielle Anwar, who, for those of us of a certain age, Gabrielle Anwar was that actress we all fell in love with. Like, it is just, she was the crush of the late 80s, early 90s. And she gets a really interesting subplot here in that she's in an arranged marriage and she actually has fallen in love with the king, and the king has fallen in love with her, but they're both stupid kids who can't tell each other. They're married.
Yeah, the king's like 12.
They're married and they can't tell each other how much they love one another because they're both afraid to be rejected by the other. And it is so good how that's dealt with. It's just so great. Of course, there's Julie Delpy as Constance, who she's in love with D'Artagnan. They kind of wrap that up, but they do also kind of say early on that a musketeer can't be with, you know, the queen's handmaidens. Like, they can't, you know, they're forbidden. So once he becomes a musketeer, he gets the girl. Like, that's the one part that it's like, I guess maybe the king's looking the other way.
That's why he was sworn in twice.
That's why he was sworn in twice
right there. I also want to talk, you mentioned that, you know, the beheading, and that got me thinking about a moment in this film where I was like, I've seen this before, and now I realize why. Is there's a scene where they're about to execute D'Artagnan, and he's on the chopping block, and wouldn't you know it, the person who's actually under the robe of the executioner is Charlie Sheen.
Oh, it's totally a Robin Hood scene. It's fucking Robin Hood.
It's also the scene from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which this director also directed.
First
of like three, like I said before, it's the first of three Scooby-Doo moments in this film where Charlie Sheen is just pretending to be people under robes.
Oh, shit. I did not realize that he was just coming off of Hot Shots Part 2 of this. Maybe that is something that they built in so that they could have doubles being there in the robes. And then he shows up when we're like, we have him for 3 hours. All right, come out. And now you're in the robe.
Yeah. And that's probably the reason why he's the only character without an arc. And I can imagine Oliver Platt like just not giving a fuck and getting drunk on set. And it's like, you know why you don't have a fucking arc? Because you showed up yesterday, you goddamn half an Estevez. Go fuck yourself.
You half an Estevez.
And he's just like, and that's why he's the only character without an arc, because he got limoed to the set the minute before they started shooting.
We've also got Hugh O'Connor playing the king, who does a really good thankless job here. Like, he is being this bold king, but he's also playing it with this sense of nervousness about being bold. Like, every proclamation he makes, he sounds unsure of himself.
Yeah.
And it's so well done. Like, it's so he's given so few scenes, and he conveys it every time. And he gets his arc. He gets the girl. He punches out fucking Richelieu. Like, he gets that great ending.
And also, we have a bona fide goddamn doctor in this film playing two roles. Paul McGann,
Paul McGann, baby.
Doctor from the late 90s plays two roles in this film.
Yes.
Which is pretty fucking awesome.
Yeah, no, I mean, this cast is unreal, and everyone came to play. Like, there is nobody that half-asses it. Even Charlie Sheen. Charlie Sheen's moments are great. The seduction scene early on when he's reading poetry and or scripture to the woman who clearly, like, this is one of those, I'm watching this scene, and every time I watch it, I think, this is the Joel Silver moment. This actress had to be somebody's girlfriend. Like, this had to be the, I'm going to give you a role in the big new Disney movie, and she is Tits McGee number two, who sits there, you know, half dressed, falling in love with Charlie Sheen, before Charlie Sheen runs out of the building.
Funny story. Yeah. You mentioned Joel Silver. Do you know who did the score for this movie?
Oh yes.
Michael Kamen of Die Hard.
And Kamen scores so good.
It's so good. I thought it was James Horner. It's so good. I spent a lot of this movie thinking it was James Horner.
Yeah, no, it's not. And this score, it's so big. And the theme that would be turned into, and I don't know if he wrote the theme and they turned it into the theme song, or they wrote the song and he turned it into the theme, but the All for Love theme that...
All for Love. And you're right, they totally were just like, well, Robin Hood had Bryan Adams. Let's get Bryan Adams and guests.
And Rod Stewart and Sting.
Yeah.
Because fuck yeah. And at the time, they were all, you know, these were all guys who were big in the 80s, and then were making comebacks, and they were making comebacks with power ballads, because power ballads were the thing in this era. And you could not fucking escape power ballads.
I'm really interested to know, I'm going to look it up here really quickly, how close this was to, it was the year after Lethal Weapon 3,
yeah,
which Sting also did a fucking song for. Yeah. So that's pretty interesting as well.
In fact, we're doubling up. Isn't Sting doing the theme song for next week's?
It's entirely possible. You're about to get stung, friends. Or Gordoned, depending on when you knew him, I suppose.
Yeah.
Your beauty would make even the most chaste of men think of impurity.
It's crazy how good this movie is and how well it holds up. Like, in rewatching it, I was afraid that there would be some things that I would have to forgive. This movie does not need any forgiveness.
Doesn't need your fucking forgiveness.
No, it is just, it is. It is great. There are a few. Let's get into the nitpicks.
All right.
Just the slight nitpicks of just, they're not a problem with the movie or enjoying the movie, but when you think about the movie, as you do after watching it 3 times in 2 weeks, as you do.
You watched it once for every musketeer.
I did.
Except for D'Artagnan.
Because he's not a musketeer yet.
Correct.
Until the end. So, yeah. So, first of all, these musketeers are such good men. They are great men. They are patriotic men. That's the other thing about this movie. This movie's so fucking jingoistic. Like, they love France the way we love America, and they really sell that hard, and it's great.
Michael Bay would not know what to do with this movie. It is so French. Like, it is so lovingly attributed to the French history.
But that, man,
I don't know what to do.
Every time a musketeer sees the church guard, the cardinal's guard, they just straight up fucking murder these guys.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they just, well, don't, they're like, you work for Richelieu? Fuck you.
I have a theory about that.
You work for Richelieu? I fucked your girl. You work for Richelieu? I'm putting a sword through you. Like, these guys don't want to put a sword through D'Artagnan. Like, D'Artagnan, who's, like, insulted their honor, and then, like, fuck it, you're musketeers, but I'm honor bound. I have to kill you now. I'm sorry. Arrogant fucking prick. But fucking Cardinal's guards show up, and it's like, wait, Did you just scuff my shoe? I'm going to fucking murder you.
It turns out the Musketeers are Cubs fans and they hate the Cardinals. But no, the bigger, the theory that I have about what's really going
Sports
on.
Sports jokes.
Right? They swing and a miss. The theory I have about what's going on there revolves around Charlie Sheen's character, actually. He talks about, you know, he was formerly of the church. Something happened. He really hates Richelieu.
He was a student of Richelieu. He fell out of love with him.
It's Catholic. It gets a little icky and makes me think maybe that's the motivation for them to straight up murder the Cardinals guards. Is something bad happened in the past?
There, yeah, and that's something that does, of course, play into the book and something that is very much of the time. You know, the church is in a bad shape in this period of time. The church is why Martin Luther nailed his treatise to the door, was because of shit like this. And it's why Richelieu, I think, has stayed as such a powerful villain for so many centuries.
Yeah, you're not going to read any think pieces that are like, well, here's five reasons you can't blame Cardinal Richelieu.
No, because he stood for everything that went wrong with the church at this time. And he does it, you know, in all the versions. Like we should at some point cover, you know, the older, the 1970s versions of these movies, which are fucking phenomenal, by the way. Three Musketeers and Four Musketeers. He is just so a great representation of all of that greed and the fact that this period of time you could pay to have your sins absolved. Like you could, you know, you could fucking murder a bunch of boys and go to the cardinal and go, here's 100 gold pieces. He goes, well, what you did is only 50. So this 50 will pay you forward for the next ones that you murder and kill.
Yikes.
And God will absolve you. And that's how the church worked for a while, that pay for absolution. And it was fucked. And so he's very much, that's where all this money is coming from. Like they don't go into that in the movie, but that's essentially why he's so rich. And this is where all this, and he's using it for all the wrong reasons. So that is, but the idea that the guards working for him, I mean, it's just that I understand it's the, you know, it's the workers on the second Death Star argument. And it's really like, we don't care. They're the bad guys. And I don't, but it is one of those things where it's like, for such righteous, upstanding guys, if you show up in red, they're going to fucking murder you.
The three bulls don't show up in red, for sure.
Yeah. So that's the one big thing. And of course I already mentioned the Constance loophole, the, you know, paradox where it's like, but you just became a musketeer. You had your chance with
wasn't
her until you became a musketeer.
Wasn't that a Robert Ludlum book, The Constance Paradox?
Should be.
You can have that title, internet. It's all yours.
Yeah. But those are the ones that really kind of stand out in watching it where it's like, you know, these guys, I don't know that the Cardinal Guard bad.
You got a little walk in there. You're like, you know, these guys.
They're just being guys.
Wearing red, it's no good. You get killed by a musketeer. The most uncomfortable place you got. But I want to bring this full circle for a second. We talked about how this movie borrows a lot from The Princess Bride. Cary Elwes was actually considered for one of the roles in this movie.
Which role, out of curiosity?
It didn't specify, but there were a lot of names that were Robert Downey Jr., Brad Pitt, a lot of people who were kind of... I mean, you need to populate this film with four hunks, which is why you go with three hunks and Oliver Platt. And I respect that.
No, no, no.
I respect that.
No, three hunks and Chris O'Donnell. Fuck you. Fuck you.
Three hunks and a guy who looks like he's part of a Lynyrd Skynyrd tribute band.
Dude,
yes, that's Oliver Platt, folks.
Oh, Oliver Platt's wenching scene in this movie is so great and believable.
Every man should get a wenching scene.
The wenching scene is pretty epic. Here's the thing I love about this movie. Here's one of the many things. Let's consider this for a moment.
Yeah.
He is D'Artagnan. Chris O'Donnell's D'Artagnan. He is the young upstart joining these guys. So we got to have a training sequence.
Yes.
All of these movies have a training sequence.
Montage.
But instead of a training montage of teaching him how to do stuff, we already acknowledge that he's doing stuff. Like he's good at swordplay. He's good enough to do this. So what are we going to do? We're going to have a training sequence of him learning how to wench.
Yes.
Of him learning how to mac on a girl. And it's a great scene. And like you said, that great line, you know, why is he sitting, why is Athos sitting alone? It's like, because Athos takes his drinking very seriously. Yeah. And then there's that great moment at the end of that scene. Oh, again, why I love this movie so much. When Porthos starts making a complete ass of himself, Athos lays him the fuck out, laughs about it, and sits down to drink, because these are the kind of friends they are. Yeah. Like, this is who these guys are. I love this. They are not dude bros. They are, you know, they are guys who have been through the shit together, and they are practically, they are just civilized barbarians.
And there's a, but there's a wittiness to the way that they're written too. One of my favorite parts of this movie is the horses start surrounding them, and Porthos says to Aramis, like, only a fool would try to arrest us twice in one day. And then immediately you hear, you're under arrest. And then they both go, fool. Like, it's just, it's so fucking rapid fire.
The banter is great. They all have a chemistry together. And the only person who doesn't have chemistry with them is the one who's not supposed to. That's why I love what Chris O'Donnell does. Yeah. And I love how douchey he is. When we open up the film,
when we open up the film and he's in Ridley Scott's The Duelist for some reason.
He's in the middle of a duel. We're supposed to side with him. This is our protagonist. We're supposed to side with him. There is this really just obnoxious guy who has like one of everyone's favorite line for this movie. D'Artagnan! I can't even hit the squeal that he hits. It's so
practically
great.
Don Knotts-ian, the it way
is.
He says it.
He's the comic relief who keeps showing up to the film. Comic relief in a very comic relief heavy movie. It's great. But so he's like, they're sword fighting. And he's like, honor says I must kill you. And he's like, nothing happened. And you realize, oh, this guy has there's been an offense that really didn't happen. And now he's going to be, this guy wants to murder him and he has to fight this guy in a duel. And he's like, look, I told your sister I was going away and she wanted to give something to remember me by, wink and a smile. And you're like, you fucking douchebag. You fucking banged his sister. And he's trying, and you're like acting like you didn't bang his sister. Dude, you banged his sister and then you taunted him for it. You asshole.
It was all for one and one for the road with that girl, if you know what I mean.
Exactly what it was. So like the first time we meet him, D'Artagnan is in all the heat he's fucking earned. And like every single thing he does in that opening sequence and how he ends up at the famous three duels at once. My favorite way into that scene, by the way, that is one of the great sequences of the novel. And I love how it happens in all the movies. It's my favorite part of a Three Musketeers movie is how he meets all three Musketeers and they all show up. And just the way the banter and the charisma of these three actors being like, you can't kill this man. Why not? I have a duel with him at 1 o'clock. It's like, I have a duel with him at 2. And it's just so great in how that scene plays out that it just, it tickles me on the inside. But D'Artagnan has earned getting stabbed to death like 4 or 5 times already in the first 5 minutes of this fucking movie. Like, this guy should not be taken seriously, but he always does the right thing at the right time. And so these guys see the value in him and see the potential in him because, you know, he does, it's for him, it really is about honor. And they go, this is an honorable guy who just needs to get knocked around a little bit and have the shit smacked out of him. So that by the time you get to the end of the movie where he does save the king, he saves the king by sliding down a roof and knocking the gun out of his hands and then wrestling around a while until fucking Porthos saves his ass.
Correct.
Because aside from that, he's not really a particularly great musketeer yet.
No, and nor does he really. Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I do think it's funny that in the small town in Austria where they actually shot this movie in that dungeon, they just left that dragon boat down there. Apparently, it was an old dungeon, but then it was flooded, you know, hundreds of years ago. So there is like a little lake down there, and they have this prop dragon boat that they were just like, and that's a landmark now. Goodbye, and it's still there.
Is it?
It's still there. You can go to this little town in Austria and visit one of the sets of Disney's Three Musketeers.
Not one of the sets. Visit the place where Tim Curry got knocked the fuck out by Hugh O'Connor and fell into the water. Like that sequence is, it's so rewarding.
You know why I'm not convinced he's dead? Because they all float down there.
Let's make it.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing.
Gee, I wonder what the junk food pairing is.
You took out your rapier and you put the finest of points right on what I was going to say, which is, of course, a deep fried Three Musketeers, comma, motherfucker.
Because holy shit, a deep fried Three Musketeers is great.
Because the thing about this movie, and we mentioned it before, is that you deep fry something and it comes out leaner. And there is no lighter candy bar than a Three Musketeers. But somehow, when you drop it into a deep vat fryer, like this movie does, taking the story of the Three Musketeers and really just junking it up, it comes out lean. I don't it's amazing how that works.
There's a lot of air in it. That's the whole thing.
There's a lot of Aramis.
That's the way it's whipped. Oh, there's a lot of Aramis.
There's a lot of Aramis. What? We're retiring forever.
Okay.
Goodbye.
So, you know, let's finish this episode off. Quick question.
All right.
If you had to be one of the Three Musketeers, which Three Musketeer would you want to be?
Porthos.
Really?
In a heartbeat.
God damn it. That's mine. I fucking love Porthos so much. I even love drunk, naked Gerard Depardieu's Porthos in Man in the Iron Masters. There's several things not to love about Man in the Iron Mask, but Gerard Depardieu's drunken Porthos is kind of a hell of a thing.
It is. It almost makes up for My Father the Hero. Also, I'm assuming that we can't... Can I pick Cardinal Richelieu? Is that a character I can be? Because... I'm sorry. Like, I know he's Tim Curry, but he's really more Tim Leary in this movie because he will not stop staring at all the women, and it's super creepy, but he fucking nails it because he's Tim Curry. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode. I hope that you will ride with us again next week. But until then, you can find our entire back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And of course, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. If you really want to toss a few gold coins into our coffer, we would greatly appreciate it. And we will reward you with bonus content that only you get to listen to.
Because you keep the lights on for us. And you know, Brian, why we do this podcast, right?
Why do we do this podcast?
We do it all for... You're not coming in?
I'm trying to remember which way it starts. Hold on. Let's
all try. For love, one for all.
God, that song is so awesomely bad. Like it really is
the one glaring part of this movie.
It's like, not a good song, but you're still just like, I'm still adding
it. Except at the time it was like, I had the cassette single of this fucking thing.
You made out with chicks to this song. Don't you deny it.
I probably banged chicks to this song.
Oh yeah. You would have. I was 9. You were probably 37. You're right. There's a difference in age between
us. I love that it's old man jokes now. Old man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
Old Man Cargill is my favorite James Mangold movie. I thought you did a great job.
There it is.
That's a movie that no one will see, but I will still really enjoy. Where can people find you, Old Man Cargill?
On Twitter and Instagram, at Massawyrm, MASSAWYRM. You can find my book in stores now, online now, in an audiobook form.
When? Wait, in an audiobook form, when?
It's out now.
Oh, now.
Now. You could, when you're done listening to us, listen to a wonderful reader read my new book to you. It's called Sea of Rust. You can find it wherever you buy books.
I'm excited to read it, guys. And you should be, too. Well, that's going to do it for this week. I just want to I want to tell you once and for all that I forgot to pick a quote for the end.
a fine red.
Always a fine red.
No!